Obviously, there are a lot of things we could talk about tonight, but we're trying to make our way through the Gospel of Mark. And tonight's lesson is a lesson in which we are really at the core of the Gospel of Mark. And so I hope that all of us will be able just to focus in on this lesson and see what Mark has to say. What we did last time was we talked about the first in a series of three prediction cycles that Mark is going to give in Mark 8, 9, and 10, which is really the center of his gospel. And in these prediction cycles, what Jesus does is he predicts his death and his resurrection. The disciples misunderstand it, and usually, each time in a way in which is very obvious, they don't understand who Jesus is. But Jesus doesn't give up on them. He keeps teaching them. And we saw at the beginning of that was the story of the blind man of Bethsaida, who Jesus gave a second touch of grace to. And that is an image of what he's going to be doing with his disciples in this section right here, giving them a second and a third touch of grace. And it's great because he continues to do that with all of us in our lives as well. And so what we're going to do tonight is we're going to look at the second and third prediction cycles. We're going to close it out, as Mark does, by looking at another story of a blind man. This is the story of the blind Bartimaeus in Jericho. And so Mark begins this section here in chapter 8, the story of a blind man. He's going to end the section with the story of a blind man. And in the middle, Jesus is trying to get his disciples who don't see him clearly to see him clearly through his predictions and also more teaching on discipleship. And by doing that, it also helps us as readers, the first century readers, and us even today, to understand more of who Jesus is and to sort of take the blinders off and really see who Jesus is. So that's what we're going to be doing tonight. And I really feel like that this is an essential part of the Gospel of Mark. So let's start in Mark 9, verses 30 and following. And I want to just read verses 30 through 37. This is a short, quick demonstration of what I'm talking about. It's the second prediction cycle. So I'm going to read it, and then I'll go back and talk about it a little bit. And I'm reading from my own translation, so if you don't follow it exactly in your Bible, that's the reason why. Okay, in verse 30, they left from there and went throughout Galilee. This is Jesus and his disciples, and Jesus did not want anyone to know about it. He taught his apprentices, saying to them, "The Son of Man will be handed into the hands of men, and they will kill him. After he has been killed, 3 days later, he will rise." That's the prediction. Now, the misunderstanding. But they did not understand his words, and they were afraid to ask him about it. We're going down to verse 33. They arrived in Capernaum. After entering a house, he questioned them, What were you arguing about on the way there?" They remained quiet because on the way they had been arguing about which of them was the greatest. So they misunderstand, but they misunderstand in a gigantic way. Jesus is going to be the suffering servant. He's come to lay down his life for people, all of humanity, and yet they're arguing about who's going to be the greatest. So what does Jesus do? He doesn't give up on him. He keeps working with them. In verse 35, he begins to teach them. Sitting down, which is the how rabbis taught, Jesus called the 12 to him and said, "Whoever wishes to be first, he shall be last and servant of all." He took a child and set the child in their midst, and he gave the child a hug and said to them, "Whoever welcomes one of these children in my name welcomes me. Whoever welcomes me does not only welcome me, but my Father who sent me." So let's go back and look at all three of these sections in this second prediction cycle and see what is going on here in the Gospel of Mark together. First, the prediction. Verses 30 through 31, he was very specific, and in each time, he's going to be very specific with his disciples, because he doesn't want them to miss it. He begins by saying the Son of Man. That's Jesus's favorite title about himself, It not only demonstrates his humanity, but it connects him to the messianic figure in the book of Daniel. And so the Son of Man will be handed into the hands of men. This is new, that he's actually going to be handed over. And of course, we will see this later on when Judas literally does hand him over. He betrays him. It's the same word that's being used there. And they will kill him. After he has been killed, 3 days later, he will rise. And so he's very specific about wait 3 days and I will come back from the dead. But even though they heard this not long ago, and this is the second time they've heard it, they still don't get it. They misunderstand his words, and they're afraid to ask. It doesn't say why they were afraid. Jesus has given them no reason to fear him. Perhaps they're just embarrassed. Embarrassed because they don't get it, and maybe they feel like they should. But they walk, and they keep going. And that's another key that's even mentioned that you see in the text in the next two verses, on the way. On the way, they're talking. On the way to Capernaum. When they reach Capernaum, they go into a house and Jesus questions them. What were you arguing about on the way? They remain quiet because on the way, they had been arguing about which of them was the greatest. On the way literally was the road that they were walking on. But on the way figuratively is following Jesus in discipleship. And following Jesus in discipleship, they should have been having a different discussion about, I'm going to be greater than you, or you're not going to be greater than me. Who's going to be the greatest? That, is especially in light of who Jesus was, that should not have been their discussion. But they're looking for a military leader. They're looking for a political leader. They're looking for a government leader. And they're looking for their place in that government or in that military or in that uprising. And so that's what they have on their mind. So they misunderstood. But not just misunderstanding a little bit and being afraid and so not asking. They followed it up by talking about something that really the disciples, who if they understood very much about Jesus at all, they should know he's not that kind of Messiah. So they really miss who Jesus is. But Jesus doesn't give up on them. And now you have really what is the literal second touch of grace. First, it happened a little earlier in chapter 8. Now in chapter 9, this is the second time Jesus tries to help them understand and see who he is. So now it's the second touch of grace. And it says, sitting down, Jesus called the 12 to him and said, whoever wishes to be first, he shall be last and servant of all. So now he teaches them about what discipleship really means. It's not about who's the greatest. It's about who's the least. It's not about who's in first place. It's actually giving up first place and deciding to be last. And it's about serving. That's what it means. It's about helping people, serving people, pouring yourself out for other people. Kenosis, which is what the word that's used in Philippians chapter 2 of who Jesus was. He poured himself out for humanity. And to illustrate this, he takes a child. And he sets the child in their midst. He gives the child a hug and he says to them, whoever welcomes one of these children in my name welcomes me. And whoever welcomes me does not only welcome me, but my Father who sent me. So to illustrate his point, Jesus takes a child and puts the child in the middle of them. And actually the child, if you'll read the next section here, and if you've been watching the videos, I point this out, the child isn't there just for this little part here, right here. It seems like Jesus keeps the child there and brings him back in to reference a little later. So he puts the child there and then does much teaching. We're just going to look at this first part right here. The word child is paideion. Paideion can mean a young child from the ages of probably 4 to 7, around in there. But it actually could also mean not only a young child, it could also mean a young servant. And he might very well have brought a young servant and sat the servant there. Why? Because that would have illustrated his point even more. But either way, the point that Jesus is making is that children in that society were considered the least. And that's what Jesus wanted them to take on that heart. If you consider yourself greatest, be least. Be the servant of all. Marina and Robaugh, in their book on childhood, or it's actually on ancient society and Roman society, they write this about children. Childhood in antiquity was a time of terror. The reason I bring this up is sometimes where we live today, if we think of, you know, what does it mean to bring a child in and say, be like this child? We might get a totally different picture than what it looked like in the first century. And when you're trying to explore and get meaning from the text of scripture, you have to go back in time. And you have to think of what were children like in the first century and how were children viewed and valued in the first century. Because honestly, if we were to take a child and if we were just to think, okay, what do children mean to us today? We might think privilege. We might think they run the show. They might think they're on the top of the food chain, because that's the way we tend to treat children in the U.S. They can run the show, but it wasn't that way in the first century. So when Jesus brings a child or a young servant and sets the child in their midst, it was a different picture than what we would think of today if we were to do the same thing. Because I've done this with my own children. You put them in the middle of everybody there and they get all the attention. But it wasn't that way in the first century. Instead, childhood in antiquity was a time of terror. The women in Luke 18, 15 through 17, who bring their infants to Jesus, are almost certainly asking him to touch them because they are sick and dying. Notice this. Children were the weakest, most vulnerable members of society. Infant mortality rates sometimes reached 30%. Another 30% of live births were dead by age 6. And 60% of the children were gone by age 16. So it was a very desperate time for children in that society. Also, children are always the first to suffer from famine, war, disease, and dislocation. And in some areas or eras, few would have lived to adulthood with both parents alive. Children had little status within the community of the family. And I want to just underscore that. They had little status. While a minor, a child was on par with a slave. So Jesus brings this child in, and that's why you got to get back into the first century setting when you are interpreting the Bible and trying to understand the Bible. Because if we just interpret the Bible in light of the way we look at children today, we're going to miss it. But if we get back into the first century, and you have to do a little extra reading, a little extra exploring to be able to do this, get into some Bible encyclopedias, some Bible dictionaries, some other books. But if you do that, it'll bring to light what Jesus is saying. What Jesus is saying when bringing a child into their midst, he is illustrating the point that he's making. You've got to be the last of all. Consider yourself not on the top rung of the ladder, but the lower rung of the ladder. And be a servant to each other. Be a person that has no rights to each other, who is there to try to help each other. And that's what he's teaching his disciples there. So it says, whoever wishes to be first, he shall be last and servant of all, and brings this child in to illustrate that point. Another thing that we might tend to do is we might tend to say, okay, he brings a child in. Now, when you think of characteristics of a child, what do you think Jesus means here? And you could bring up all kinds of things. Well, they're teachable, where they're humble, where they're playful, and all those things can be true. But it's better to look at the context and let the context tell you the point that's being made. The point that Jesus is making about a child and why he brings a child in their midst it's not that they're playful. It's not that they're humble. It's not that they're gregarious. It's not that they are the life of the party. It's not that all eyes are drawn to them. It's that in that society, they were the least of all. And what he's saying is, if you're going to follow me, it's not about greatness. It's not about who's first in line. It's about giving up your rights and being the least of all, which is what he illustrated by dying on the cross for all of us. And so what I would ask us all to do tonight is, I would ask us just to reflect on our own lives and how are we doing being the type of person that is the least of all? Or are we the type of person that is trying to constantly grab hold of our rights and striving to be great, striving to be known as the one who is great, that kind of thing? So that's the lesson on discipleship that Jesus is teaching here. And that is the second prediction cycle. Jesus predicts his death. The disciples misunderstand it, and they're on the way, and they're following Jesus to Capernaum. They have an argument about who's the greatest. Jesus teaches them about, it's not about being greatest in his kingdom. It's about learning to be least in his kingdom. And the person that learns to be least, they're the person that fits into the kingdom of Jesus. Okay, now we're going to skip some material here, but it's already been videoed, and I have it on the video site, so it's on my Vimeo site. If you want to look at more in Mark chapter 9, and if you want to look at the first part of Mark chapter 10, it's already there. What we're going to do now is we're going to jump down to the third prediction cycle, and this is found in beginning in chapter 10, verse 32. So turn over there, and I'm going to scroll down there. Okay, so now we're at Mark 10, verse 32, and we're going to first look at Mark 10, 32 through 35, and we're going to look at the third prediction cycle. Then I want to close out by looking at the story of blind Bartimaeus in Jericho, and that'll be verses 46 through 52, and we'll close out this section of Mark by looking at the second story of a blind man. But before that, the third prediction cycle. If you go and you look at verses 32 through 34, you're going to see Jesus predict his death for the third time. And this time, notice, he's more specific than the other two times. He adds more detail. So he really wants them to understand. He wants them to get it. He wants them to understand what's going to happen to him. He doesn't want him to be surprised by it. And that was the nature of Jesus. When you get to Mark 13, it's the same thing about understanding the destruction of Jerusalem. He doesn't want them to be surprised by that. And so he teaches them about it and tells them about it. And that's how Jesus was. He really attempted to train his disciples. So verse 32, they were on the road that went up to Jerusalem, and Jesus was walking ahead of them. The apprentices marveled at him, but the ones who followed behind were afraid. Now notice they're on the road, and again, on the road, on the way is language for both literally being on a path or on a road, but also following him in the way of discipleship. Once again, he took the 12 aside and began to tell them what was going to happen to him. This is the third prediction cycle. Jesus said, "Look, we're going up to Jerusalem. The Son of Man will be handed over to the chief priests and to the experts of religious law, the scribes, and they will condemn him to death and hand him over to the Gentiles. They will ridicule him, spit on him, scourge him, and kill him. and after 3 days he will rise. So Jesus predicts his death again. This is for the third time, but he's much more specific this time than the other two times. He again uses the title Son of Man, his favorite title about himself. He mentions specifically the chief priest and the scribes, that before it talked about him being handed over, but now handed over to the chief priest and the scribes, and they're going to condemn him to death. They're the ones that are going to put him on trial. But they don't have the power, and it's amazing he tells this detail even before it happens, they don't have the power to actually condemn him to death, so he's going to be handed over to the Gentiles or the Romans. And so Herod and Pilate will decide his fate, because even though they want to kill him and have been wanting to kill him for quite a while now, they don't have the power to do that. But notice very specifically, he says they will ridicule him. And you can see these things when we get to the cross in Mark. You'll see all of these things happen just as Jesus predicted. They will ridicule him, spit on him, scourge him, and kill him. And after 3 days, he will rise. Each time he talks not just about his death, but also about his resurrection. So this time he mentions the Jewish hierarchy. He also mentions the Gentiles or the Romans. And he gets very specific about what's going to happen to him in his at the crucifixion while he's on the cross, well, before and while he's on the cross. So do the disciples get it this time? Do they understand that they are with someone who is about to die? Do they understand that Jesus as a Messiah is not going to be like King David riding in on a white horse and a military leader, political leader, who's going to basically kick the Romans out of the land? He's not going to be like the Hasmonean leaders, like Judas Maccabeus, who started war and rebellion against Rome to try to get Rome out of the land. That's not the type of leader. That's the type of leader they were wanting, but that's not the type of leader Jesus was going to be. He was going to be the suffering servant of Isaiah 53. He was going to be like a lamb who is brought for sacrifice, the Passover lamb. And he was going to lead, not through strength and power, but with by humility and by love and by service, which is still the way that his kingdom ought to be led and ought to portray that type of persona to the world around. So verse 35, do they get it? Do they understand? Well, 35 through 39 shows us that no, they do not. And again, they miss it quite badly. James and John, the sons of Zebedee, went up to him saying, now he's just, get this, you know, he's just predicted his death and how it's going to happen with the ridicule, being spit upon, being scourged. He says, teacher, grant us this favor. Do whatever we ask you to do for us. So Jesus, grant us a favor. As if Jesus is a genie in a bottle. Grant us our wish. We have something that we want you to do for us. Jesus said to them, what favor do you want me to give to you? And then in verse 37, allow us to sit next to you in your glory, one on your right and one on your left. And so they're still looking for a king who's going to be on the throne, and he's going to have somebody on the right of the throne and on the left of the throne, and they want those places. But Jesus says in verse 38, you do not understand what you ask. Are you able to drink the cup that I drink, or be submerged in the immersion with which I am engulfed? They misunderstand it so much. I mean, Jesus is talking about suffering. That's the cup he was going to drink. He's been very clear three times that that's his cup. But they say, we are able. Yeah, we got this. We're ready. We're ready to go. they just do not understand. But then Jesus, again, he doesn't give up on them there. He's given a second touch of grace and now a third touch of grace, because he's going to keep working with them and he's going to teach them. And he does that in these next few verses here. The second half of 39. But Jesus said to them, "You will drink the cup I drink and be submerged in the immersion in which I am, I will be engulfed. But to sit on my right or on my left is not mine to give, but it is for those to whom it has been prepared." And has been prepared means that God is preparing it, and God's going to make that decision. When the 10 heard about this, they became angry with James and John. And notice that James and John aren't the only ones that miss it, and they're not the only ones that misunderstand Jesus, because when they heard this, what they should be thinking about, and they should be challenging James and John, "Don't you get it? Don't you understand? He's been talking about his death. He's going to Jerusalem to die. You know, you shouldn't be talking to him about that. But instead, it says that they were angry with James and John. And the reason probably is that they didn't think of it first. They wanted to be in on this. So Jesus called all of them to him when he sees them arguing about this. He calls all of them. And he says, and he teaches them this. So we've had the prediction, we've had the misunderstanding, now we're going to have the teaching. "You know that those who recognize as rulers of the Gentiles lord it over them, and their great ones exercise authority over them. It should not be this way with you." So he's saying, sitting on my right and my left, you're looking for power, you're looking for authority. That's the way the Gentiles do it. That's not the way I do it. "It should not be this way with you. Whoever wishes to be great will be your servant, and whoever wishes to be first will be slave of all. For even the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve and to give his life as a ransom for many." So Jesus basically reiterates the same teaching that he gave before when he put the child in their midst. And the idea is that you're to be servants. You are to be the least. You're to be last. You're not to strive for the greatest spot, the greatest seat. You're to give that to somebody else so that you can serve. Let me just mention one or two other things, and then we're going to move on to blind Bartimaeus. One writer, his name is Williams, and his commentary says this: "Apparently the other 10 were angry because James and John were cutting in ahead of them to gain an unfair advantage in the competition for the places of highest rank. All of this, the request of James and John and the angry response of the other disciples, demonstrates the continuing need for instruction on what it means to be great in the context of the kingdom of God." And so Jesus teaches them what it means. And what it means to be great is to be a servant. Jesus uses the word dikaionos here. Dikaionos is a word that means to serve, but it's also the word that means minister, and is often translated as minister. But it's ministering by serving. It's the person who serves food at tables, who waits on guests, who makes sure that needs are met. And that's how Jesus envisions leadership in his kingdom. It's all about serving other people. And that's what he wants his disciples to understand. So let's close out by looking at the story of blind Bartimaeus. It's found beginning in verse 46. Remember back in Mark 8, we started with the blind man of Bethsaida, who Jesus gave a second touch of grace to so that he would see. Through the next chapters, 8, 9, and 10, we've looked at the disciples missing the prediction of Jesus every time. And now we end up this section with another story of a blind man. This is called scholars call this an inclusio. It's also called a chiasm. And that means, an inclusio means that something begins and something ends, and then the stuff in the middle is the really important stuff. And in this case, the stuff in the middle is about discipleship, and it's about who Jesus is as Lord. And that's the really important stuff that Mark is trying to drive home here. But to illustrate that, he begins with the story of a blind man and ends with the story of a blind man. And even though the blind men physically could not see Jesus, they spiritually understood him better than those who could see, the 12 who could see, understood him. And that's the point that Mark is making. So, now, they came to Jericho. Jericho is actually the lowest city on earth, and it's the oldest, well, it in Damascus in Syria, spar for the title of the oldest continually occupied city on earth. It sits at the bottom of the Rift Valley, some 1,300 feet below sea level. And to get up to Jerusalem, you have to climb to 2,500 feet above sea level. So it's quite a climb to get up to Jerusalem from Jericho. There was water there, there was an oasis there, and so a community was built around that oasis. They come to Jericho, which means they come through the Jordan Valley, and now they're about to climb up to Jerusalem. As he was leaving Jericho with his apprentices, a large crowd followed him. The blind beggar named Bartimaeus, the son of Timaeus, sat by the road. When he heard that Jesus of Nazareth was there, Bartimaeus began to cry out, saying, "Son of David, Jesus, have mercy on me." Now notice the title that he uses for Jesus. It's not Son of Man, it's Son of David. So he is looking at Jesus as a kingly figure. And he says, "Have mercy on me." But the people rebuked him. Many people rebuked him. "Be quiet," they said. He cried out all the more, "Son of David, have mercy on me." Jesus stopped and said, "Call him here." They brought the blind man, saying to him, "Have courage, get up, he calls you." Casting off his outer cloak, he jumped up and came to Jesus. Answering him, Jesus said, "What do you wish I should do for you?" The blind man said, "Rabboni, I want to receive sight." Notice he doesn't say, "I want to be greatest." He's not arguing about which side of the throne he's going to be on. He wants to see. He wants to see, which really is what the disciples should have been asking for. Help us to see you as you really are. Jesus said to him, "Go, your faith has saved you." Immediately he received his sight and he followed on the way. So just a couple of things that I want to mention here. One commentator that I was reading made an interesting point in verse 50. It says, casting off his outer cloak, he jumped up and came to Jesus. The outer cloak was, it was what a blind beggar would have used to put out in front of him to get alms and to get a contribution. As people walked by, he would call out, and they would throw coins into his outer cloak. In other words, it was like his workplace. But what he does is he just cast it aside. He cast it aside and cast aside his means of livelihood to get to Jesus and to get there faster. And so he leaves that behind and goes to Jesus. Notice that when he gets there and Jesus... this time, Jesus is the one that says to him, and look at the wording. It says, "What do you wish that I should do for you?" Remember James and John? Jesus, can you do us a favor? Now, what Jesus is saying, what favor can I do for you? He's offering him a favor. But instead of asking for greatness, or instead of asking for a seat at the right or the left, he simply says, "I want to see. Help me to see." He doesn't ask for glory. He doesn't ask for fame. He just asks for sight. And what if the disciples had done that instead? What if they had asked for sight? insight into who Jesus really was. And then the last thing that I want you to see about this blind man is that Jesus said to him, "Go, your faith has saved you." Immediately he received his sight. And so now he's got what he wanted. Jesus says, "What favor can I do for you?" He says, "Give me sight." He's got what he wanted. And he says, "Go, just as Jesus, go, your faith has saved you." But notice he doesn't go. He doesn't just run away with his sight and leave Jesus. He says he followed Jesus. And where does he follow him? He follows him on the way. And where does the way lead for Jesus? For Jesus, the way leads, goes up that 3,000 plus feet climb to Jerusalem, where he's going to die. He follows him on into Jerusalem, which is what every disciple must do, is that we must follow Jesus into Jerusalem, and we must take up our cross as Jesus took up his cross. And there is really a big point of all of this is there is no discipleship of Jesus without a cross. So he follows Jesus to Jerusalem, which leads to Golgotha, which leads to a cross, which leads to a death, which leads to a resurrection, which leads to a fulfillment of all three of his predictions. Jürgen Moltmann, who's a German scholar, in his book called Experience of God, says this: Christ's passion does not just begin when he is taken prisoner and tortured by the Roman soldiers. It begins at the moment when he resolves to go to Jerusalem with his disciples. His passion for the messianic future, which he had brought to living expression in the gospel for the poor, in the healing of the sick, and the forgiveness of sins, was bound to come up against its most determined enemies in Jerusalem, where its strongest opponents were the priests of Jesus' own people and the Roman forces of occupation. So the threat that the Son of Man must suffer many things and be rejected hung heavy over the road to Jerusalem. And that's the exact road that blind Bartimaeus follows Jesus on. And if we're going to be disciples of Jesus today, then we're going to have to walk that same road with Jesus, which is really the point of this middle section of Mark. There is no discipleship of Jesus without walking the way to the cross and taking up our own cross and following him. So I just want to point out again, one last time. I think that this is such a beautiful story, and I think it's such a beautiful part of Mark, because I can see the genius of Mark as he pulls these stories together and retells the story. He begins with a blind man, the blind man of Bethsaida, and Jesus gives him a second touch of grace. And then he ends with the blind man, the blind Bartimaeus of Jericho. And both of these blind men are actually visualizing and seeing Jesus without their sight. They're seeing Jesus better than the disciples are going to see him. And the reason is because of faith. The disciples are there with Jesus every day, looking at him literally with their physical eyes, seeing him literally, but they miss him on a spiritual plane. But Jesus doesn't give up on them, just like he will not give up on us. He works that second touch of grace into a third touch of grace, and he predicts his death three times, each time they miss it, but he teaches them and continues to teach them. And really, it's not until the resurrection, in which they see Jesus resurrected from the dead in the glory of the Father, that's when they finally get it. And that's when all these teachings come true for them. And they visualize Jesus and see him, and their spiritual blinders fall off, and they become like the blind man of Bethsaida and blind Bartimaeus and really see Jesus. It's after the resurrection. And at that point, what Jesus has taught them along the way about being a servant, about being the least, about being last, about serving others, about the kainos, what ministry really is, its service. That's when they finally get it. And the beautiful thing is after they get it, they never let go of it. After they really get it, they will live their lives out as servants of Jesus, serving humanity and helping other people to come to Jesus. So it's an upward calling. It's an upward calling for all of us. I would just ask all of us tonight to really, let's see Jesus with eyes of faith tonight and try to take our spiritual blinders off and see him as he really is. Thank you.